The Israeli-Palestinian conflict is the longest ongoing hot and cold war of the 20th and 21st centuries. It has produced more refugees than any current conflict, generating fully one quarter of all refugees worldwide. Everyone knows that the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is important itself and is also fueling tensions throughout the Middle East. Yet most people shy away from this conflict, claiming it is too complicated and too complex to understand. Sociologist Eve Spangler has written a new book to provide a point of entry into the conversation. It is called Understanding Israel, Palestine, Race, Nation, and Human Rights in the Conflict. Eve Spangler is a sociologist and a human and civil rights activist. For the last decade, her work is focused on the Israel-Palestine conflict, and we welcome her to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for the invitation. I'm honored.
What brought you to this particular subject? Obviously, this encompasses a lot of your work of helping people understand Israel and Palestine.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I should start by saying I'm Jewish. I come from a family that was devastated by the Holocaust. And so coming out of that experience, when that sits in the middle of your family history, there are people who say never again to my people, and they become Zionists. And there are folks like my parents who say never again to anyone, and they become very interested in human rights. So the deep background of this book is that I grew up in a family dedicated to human rights, to being suspicious of states, not romanticizing states, but thinking you have to be ever vigilant. And that's the deep background. That's the sort of faded part. Of course, there's also circumstance and coincidence in life. And so I was minding my own business, sitting in my office one night about to go home, and a colleague came and said, "You've got to come to this talk I arranged. It's on Israel-Palestine." And I thought, oh, darn, I wanted to read my book club novel and drink a glass of wine, but I went to the talk, and I got completely hooked. The Palestinian speaker spoke first, and he talked about the expulsion of Palestinians, two-thirds of all Palestinians, the demolition of three-quarters of their villages and all of their cities that was connected to the founding of the State of Israel. And I was shocked because I'd known nothing about this. I'd heard nothing about this. And then there was an Israeli speaker, and I thought, okay, well, it's the Palestinian voice. Let's hear what the Israeli has to say. And he got up and pointed to the Palestinian and said, what he said is an understatement. So I was hooked. I began reading about it. I began teaching a seminar in the fall semester on human rights in the conflict. And then I began going and seeing for myself. Then I began taking my students. So for 7 years now, over winter break, I've taken students from my seminar to talk to human rights people in Israel and Palestine. And then it finally dawned on me that I was never going to teach that many people. So I wrote the book to reach out to the people who aren't in the class with me.
So in the end, and I realize I'm jumping ahead a little bit, I obviously want to get to the details, but when we finish reading the book, you want us to have accomplished what? Not certainly take a stand one way or the other.
Well, actually, I do want people to take a stand, not one way or the other between Israelis and Palestinians, but to take a stand that human rights is the right standard. Now, that implies that we actually don't get to tell either Israelis or Palestinians what to do, but human rights is the standard for Americans to behave in this conflict, and particularly for the American government to behave in this conflict. And I do hope that at the end of the book I've convinced people that that would be the right standard in acting in this conflict.
Why is it a conflict that so many of us shy away from and do not want to discuss because of its complications?
Well, I think the complications actually are, I mean, one hesitates to say this, but the complications aren't so great. It's actually a good time to be attending to it because the archives are now open. And the disagreements now between Israelis and Palestinians are not so much about the facts anymore, you know, except for the knuckleheads on either side. But the competent people who are literate and who read the best research are agreed on the facts of the expulsion of the Palestinians that was associated with the creation of the State of Israel, are agreed that the occupation is illegal, are agreed that the settlements are eating up the possibility of a Palestinian state. those facts are not so much in controversy, and so that complexity is eliminated. The difficulty is, what do we do in the face of it? I think partly we are so bewildered because our press has not, you know, given us the whole story. The conversation, the framework, and the facts don't fit together very well. So the framework is all about Israeli safety. And the facts are that, for example, in Operation Protective Edge last year, the massacre in Gaza, the Israelis killed 2,200 Palestinians, 70% of whom, by Amnesty International estimates, were civilians, 500 of whom were children. And at the same time, the Palestinians killed 72 Israelis, 4 of whom were civilians. Now, if you heard those statistics about, I don't know, Peru and Ecuador, you would have a very different sense of who's the hazard, who's the aggressor here, who's making whom unsafe. And so our facts and our frameworks don't go together. That is what I think is the difficulty.
If we are to, as you call for, to bring human rights standards as the basis to consider this conflict, how does that change the discussion that we have, and what is the most important baseline to have when having that discussion?
The most important baseline is that every single human being who lives in Israel-Palestine is equally valuable, equally entitled to dignity, to safety, to a normal life. Israel and Palestine together are slightly larger than the state of New Jersey, and it's a landmass that's situated, at the eastern end of the Mediterranean. It's the land bridge between Europe and Asia and Africa and Asia. And so it's been, from biblical times forward, the most multicultural, multi-ethnic, multiracial, multi-everything place you can imagine. And human rights would say all of those people who are there now with very mixed ancestries, both Jews and Palestinians, very mixed ancestries, all of those people get to stay. They get to, nobody gets pushed into the sea. They get to live a life where there's rule of law, there's dignity, there's accountability for whatever form the government takes. And so we have to look forward into the future. We have to start by saying everybody who's here gets to stay here. Now, how do we ensure that everybody is treated decently?
You do talk in the book about the importance of having a framework, and I'm just curious as to what that human rights framework looks like.
Well, it looks very much like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It looks like the Geneva Conventions on the rules of war that try to say even in wartime it's not a world where everything goes. And, you know, you would think that people who focus on the Holocaust as part of their heritage would be very, very concerned to establish some baseline of rule of law, because Jews are a tiny minority of the world population. They're 2% in the United States, and more than half the Jews in the world choose not to live in Israel. And so you would think that Israel would really insist on rule of law as, you know, the best guarantee of its own safety. But instead, they're shredding the Geneva Conventions. The Geneva Conventions are unambiguously clear. An occupying power can neither move its own civilians into the occupied territories, that would be 700,000 illegal settlers in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, nor can they depopulate the civilian population of the occupied entity. They cannot drive out Palestinians as they are with social policies that make life unlivable. You know, most people in Gaza are not only stateless, they're homeless. They have no roofs over their head. And so, you know, this is shredding international law. This is shredding any sense that even in war, everything doesn't go. The schoolyard bully doesn't own the schoolyard.
One of the things that you talk about in the book is that, and you mentioned this early on, about how we often lose sight of the facts. We often lose sight of what we actually know. And I'm curious as to how you think that we should go about to distinguish facts from propaganda and myths and exaggerations that come that are inherent in any kind of deep-seated conflict?
Indeed they are. And so, you know, as I've said before, there's now a body of scholarship, you know, it does involve some effort to read some of that, in which, you know, a certain fundamental set of facts is no longer disputed. Whether you read Benny Morris, probably the most prominent Israeli historian, who does not deny the facts of expulsion, but celebrates them as, you know, ethnic cleansing was necessary for the creation of the State of Israel. If you read Ari Shavit, who's a journalist and wrote the enormously popular My Promised Land, he makes the same argument, but for ethnic cleansing, we couldn't exist. I think we have to question any kind of political project that cannot exist but for ethnic cleansing. Why should we be supporting such a project?
With that said, then, I I'm curious as just to of how we then have the conversation, because we almost have to have blinders on to forget all of the other stuff that we've seen and heard.
It is very difficult, of course, because in general, Americans know more about American history than European and more about European than the Third World. And so we have heard always the version of the Holocaust means that Jews have to have a safe house, a room of their own, and anyone else who happens to be living in that space has to just leave. And we've heard that in the novel Exodus. We've heard that in a million movies. And so that is a framework that needs to be broken. I think an analogy that Americans can usefully contemplate is the civil rights movement. You have in Christian Europe Jews being mistreated, ghettoized, pogroms, all kinds of terrible behavior culminating in the Holocaust. You have in African Americans in America slavery and Jim Crow and lynchings and Ferguson and Black Lives Matter. So these are two communities that rest uneasily in their host society. What do we do about that? Most people simply want to go along to get along. For most people, going to work, getting the kids to school, and remembering to send your mother-in-law a birthday card, that's pretty much work enough. That's assimilation. Some people have the energy to try to reform the systems that marginalize them. That would be the civil rights movement in America, often socialism for Jews in Europe. And some people come to the conclusion that there is no hope where they are. They have to leave. And that would be the Back to Africa movement in American history and Zionism in Jewish history. And you have to say up front, of course, Israel is vastly more economically successful than Liberia. But apart from that, the parallels between Back to Africa and Zionism are really striking. Most of the people to whom those projects were addressed wanted no part of it, said, "You want to go where? Good luck with that." The leaders of both Back to Africa and Zionism were very skilled in lobbying governments, in raising money, and recruiting some settlers. The leaders of both movements had allies, some of whom were genuine human rights people who thought, you know, you ought to get to go where you want to go, and I'll help you with that. But many of whom were very racist, whites who were happy to get blacks out of America, Christians who were happy to get Jews out of Europe. Both of them were opportunistic about where they landed, Liberia and Palestine. Those were places great power ceded to them. And both of them, when they arrived, rode roughshod over the indigenous populations. So I think if people could reframe this a little bit in terms of what we do know about the American civil rights movement, that would be a big step forward.
You mentioned just a moment ago the word hope. And one of the things that comes through reading the book is that you are hopeful that we can reach a solution.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I am, and I hope realistically and not in just some, you know, kind of greeting card way. And I'm hopeful for a number of reasons. First of all, because I think Americans do have tools to change American government. We've changed the American government around civil rights, around the Vietnam War, around women's rights, gay rights, to some degree around environmental issues. So we know how to do that. There are already conversations in churches and on campuses going forward in that direction. we do have the right to free speech and free assembly. We can ask that our government enforce its own laws. We can engage in boycotts. My very first boycott experience was in New York City in 1964 as part of the civil rights movement. So there's a very ancient and honorable tradition in America of boycotts for social good. So we have tools, and we have partners in Palestine and in Israel, both people working within their own communities and people working across the border. And the basic populations, aside from the god-awful politicians, and I realize saying that is a little bit like saying, apart from that, Mrs. Lincoln, did you like the play? But really, the basic Israeli and Palestinian populations are actually quite compatible. They're both ferociously dedicated to education. Palestinians have the highest per capita PhDs of any Arab population. They introduce themselves by telling you how many children they have and how much education each child has. They're both very entrepreneurial populations. Palestinians had a favorable balance of trade with Europe for a century before Zionists arrived. So these are educated, entrepreneurial populations. So there is the possibility there, at least as much as there was in South Africa, of a peaceful resolution and a stable, educated, actually economically thriving and bustling society there. The problems are political.
You ultimately see a one-state solution. What would that look like?
It would look like, I'm not being snide here, but it would look like something like America. It would be multicultural and multi-ethnic, and people would vote, and some people would be more invested in their ethnic hyphenated identities, and some would be less so. But it's interesting to me that people find the notion that Israel should become a multi-ethnic, multicultural state of all its people so bizarre when they're sitting in America, which is a multicultural, multi-ethnic, imperfect, to be sure, state of all its people. It would certainly change Israel to become such a place. It would not destroy it any more than leaving India destroyed England or leaving Vietnam destroyed France or South Africa was not destroyed by the end of apartheid. But it would be, of course, a very big change.
The name of the book is Understanding Israel, Palestine, Race, Nation, and Human Rights in the Conflict. It is published by Sense Publishers. Eve Spangler, thank you very much for joining us this morning. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Oh, Joe, this was wonderful. Thank you very, very much for having me.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book, Understanding Israel, Palestine, by Eve Spangler. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.